It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Sandy Rios with you, and yes, some things are worth fighting for. I started the show yesterday this very same way. It is actually pretty amazing to me that this whole thing of potential hacking into our voting system, which I believe is a sham to prepare us to take over and nationalize elections in November, the more I hear, the more I believe that's the case. And before anyone was reporting this, we had a conversation with Hans von Spakovsky on this very show on Monday morning. I want you to hear again what Hans had to say when I asked him about the announcement that Jay Johnson made that this was critical infrastructure and perhaps the federal government might have to take over the voting system. Let's listen to Hans from Monday.
This is the same White House that says there's no voter fraud in the United States. You know, they deny that voter fraud ever occurs, and yet suddenly they're saying, oh, we may need to designate as critical infrastructure the American election system. Now, what most people don't realize is that that's very pertinent language because after 9/11, we passed this federal statute that allows the president or the Secretary of Homeland Security, if he does that designation, it means that the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department, the FBI, are given special authority to go in and try to thwart any potential terrorist or other activity or attacks on that critical infrastructure. And so this would give the Justice Department, for example, suddenly power over precincts and polling places all across the country, something they don't have right now. And listen, he was asked, that is Jay Johnson, he was specifically asked by one of the state secretaries of state, Tom Scheduler of Louisiana, whether they've got any evidence of any credible threat against our system, and Jay Johnson's answer was no.
All right, so that was Hans von Spakovsky on Monday. Hans is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and an expert on voter fraud. And that's what we were talking about, but not necessarily that. It's just that I happen to remember that story by Jay Johnson, which I think came out maybe a month, 6 weeks ago, something like that. So we played the story, and now everyone's writing about this. And it was amazing to me after hearing Hans say that the director of Homeland Security, the FBI, the Justice Department have the power, according to statute passed after 9/11, to take over the voting system. It was amazing then to me to hear the FBI director stand up yesterday and say what he did. This is a Catherine Herridge report from Fox News. Let's listen.
We take very seriously any effort by any actor, including nation states, maybe especially nation states, that moves beyond the collection of information about our country and that offers the prospect of an effort to influence the conduct of affairs in our country, whether that's an election or something else.
Today, two more Democrats joined Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, calling on the FBI to investigate alleged connections between the Trump campaign and Russian interests and whether that relationship contributed to attacks on the Democratic Party website.
And that's exactly what I said Monday. You can see it coming. They're going to link Donald Trump with the Russian government, allege that the Russian government is hacking our voter system, and if the election, if by chance he should win it, or if it's close, they will use that to take over the voting system, federalize it, and heaven knows what will happen after that. That's really what I think is going to happen. It sounded like tinfoil maybe on Monday, but I can't believe that in the last 48 hours, this is actually what's happening. they're unfolding this whole, laying the groundwork for all of this. The Washington Examiner, Paul Bedard, did a story on it just yesterday, saying much the same, talking about what Hans did about critical infrastructure. Then the Daily Beast, which is an affiliate of Newsweek, came out talking about how voter files are shockingly easy to hack. But, you know, could I just point out something? If you were concerned about someone hacking for your information, would it be your voter file? Would it not be maybe your credit card or, you know, your medical information? I would submit to you that our voter files are probably the most innocuous information about all of us, our name and address. So really, this is going to be the object of, you know, Russian hackers are going to go to this great trouble to look into our voter information? I just think it's just silly. It's really, really silly. And it really bothers me. It frightens me, actually, that Comey, the head of the FBI, should now come out and be sort of advancing this narrative. Now, maybe he's right. Let's see. Maybe I'm all wrong about this. But I'm telling you, people have lost so much trust in the FBI, and I think rightfully so, that I cannot assure you that the FBI director is not himself at least advancing an agenda, whether he's doing it, talking about it and plotting and planning, or just his sympathies are with the left. I don't know. Down in Texas, we're just hearing today that there have been terrible voter abnormalities at least two different counties. They found 1,800 votes in Hill County. 1,800 more votes were cast than there were even voters in the county. And now they're investigating a second county, Tarrant County. And the election commissioner there is saying, well, yes, we did kind of notice, you know, that there were some maybe irregularities, shall we say, with these mail-in ballots. But I didn't mention it because, you know, I'm not the police. That's basically what he said. So now they're looking into that. But we've got a serious problem with potential voter fraud in this upcoming election. And I am driving it home. I'm driving it home on purpose because I want you to be aware. You know, I think that we were all shocked at what happened during the Bush-Gore presidential election. I remember being on the air in Chicago and it consumed us. I covered it every single day. I wished it would go away. It went on for months and it nearly wrecked the presidential election, whatever was behind all of it. I'm sure there are lots of different opinions on that. But I'm telling you, I think they're gearing up to do something like that. Same but different. So we just have to be prepared for it, and maybe even we can fight on it, fight against it. I'm working on that. We're talking about it here, so we'll let you know. If we come up with a solution, we'll let you know. All right, well, speaking of elections, there were several yesterday, I think, of consequence. One of them was John McCain in the primary against Kelly Ward in Arizona. Fox is reporting that he easily defeated his challengers, but didn't give numbers. So I don't know. Since I started show prep, maybe numbers have come out, but I don't know what they are. So Kelly Ward has defeated John McCain, the incumbent, who makes terrible decisions. I'll go on record right here as telling you I think John McCain is a disgrace. But Arizona wants him back, so they got him. Paul Gosar, who was really a champion in the House, was under attack. I think the Republican leadership were trying to get him out because he was one of the champion congressmen who was trying to get John Boehner out. But they didn't succeed, and so he won his primary. That's good news. Also, Sheriff Joe Arpaio prevailed in Arizona. I think it's his sixth election, and he won handily. So, and I think he had two strong opponents, so that's a good thing, too. Good for Sheriff Joe. And then in Florida, Dan Bongino, who we talked about, was defeated by a millionaire, donor to the Republican Party, who I think put something like $32 million into his own race. So Dan Bongino, who's the former Secret Service agent, was defeated in his race yesterday. So those are just the ones. I'm sure there are others, but those are the ones I had been talking about and wanted to update you on. And just as a personal update, could I just say that you guys are unbelievable? I mean, really. The listeners of AFR Talk are unbelievable. You may recall that yesterday we talked to the spokesperson for India Partners, and we were talking about they needed a second dorm for boys because the government last minute told them they can't house boys and girls together, even on separate floors. So they had to build a whole new building. an entire new building to put the boys in, and they had to do it by September 15th, have broken ground, have everything. And so we did a one-day campaign, and I told, I can't think of his name. You guys can help me a little bit. I told
David Harms
that our listeners are phenomenal. But I guess I didn't realize how phenomenal. Could I just say that our goal was $148,000? And as of yesterday, we had received $210,425, 1,422 people called to pledge their money and their resources. And that is so moving to me, I can't even tell you. So could I just say thank you? That's amazing, the generosity. Because I know a lot of you are struggling. And some of you, you know, we don't have confidence about the future financially. So I know that almost every single person that wrote out a check or called and pledged some money did that out of a generosity and not out of, you know, having, you know, an abundance and no worry. So thank you for your generosity and your care. And because of you, this building will be built, this dorm for these little boys, and India Partners can move ahead. I'm sure it'll be a great blessing to them to know that they had your support. So thank you for doing that. Oh, man, I'm running out of time here. So what shall I talk about? I guess I need to talk about Catherine's report on Mrs. Clinton's email because it's amazing. Let's roll on number one.
Hillary Clinton has said consistently that she turned over all her government emails, but tonight the State Department is confirming about 30 records that may be related to the 2012 terrorist attack are among the thousands recovered by the FBI from Clinton's server. The department is working to confirm the exact number and whether any are duplicates, and already posted online as more records from the FBI become public.
Law enforcement sources say portions of the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's email practices could be released as early as this week, possibly Wednesday, but emphasize the review is ongoing. President Obama's spokesman said the White House is not involved.
I've seen those reports. I can tell you that the White House did not consult with the FBI about that decision or any of the other decisions that they've made in terms of handling some of the investigative material.
After FBI Director James Comey's July statement where he recommended against criminal charges,
we are expressing to justice our view that no charges are appropriate in this case.
Media outlets filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the Bureau, forcing the public release. The expectation is that the redacted files will likely include the FBI's recommendation to the Justice Department against criminal charges, the summary of Clinton's FBI interview known as a 302, as well as the backup notes from agents who questioned her. While the FBI director said there was no evidence of criminal intent by Clinton and her team to move classified information outside secure government computer networks, Republicans who read the FBI files sent to Congress earlier this month claim agents never pressed Clinton.
He said he didn't go forward with charges because she didn't have specific criminal intent. I didn't see any questions on that. She said she did it for convenience, but I didn't see the follow-up questions in the interview I read.
Today, the Clinton campaign welcomed the file's release. And before the news became public, the FBI director was speaking at a cybersecurity conference where he joked about avoiding more discussion of the closed national security investigation.
I'd like to take your questions, and I'm hoping you're going to think up a question that has nothing to do with Secretary Clinton's emails.
All right, so that was the first part of Catherine's report on Fox News yesterday. Yeah, so they have found, the Department of State saying now they found 30 deleted Clinton email on Benghazi. And, you know, interestingly enough, I don't think they've found any email that are personal. Remember she said she deleted all those email because they were personal about Chelsea's wedding, about yoga, about whatever, you fill in the blank. But strangely enough, none of those seem to have shown up. But now they have some about Benghazi. And, of course, that's of tremendous interest to all of us. Remember that she used bleach, whatever, the bleach something, to cleanse her unit. She had used her attorney. She used technicians. She thought she had totally wiped out a certain email. I mean, and one can assume it wasn't about yoga and a wedding. So it'll be interesting to see these email may actually come out today, these exchanges on Benghazi. But, you know, who knows? Mrs. Clinton is still ahead in the polls. So, and remember that most Americans are still not hearing all of this. Those of you that listen to AFR, American Family Radio, are a select group. So here we go, speaking the truth as best we can. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Since I've led tours for many years to the Holy Land, Israel, many people ask me, what's your favorite place to go? I have two, really. the Garden Tomb and Calvary and the Sea of Galilee. Now, I like all the places we stopped along the way in Israel, but those two places in particular are very special and meaningful. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We'll be going to all the places you've read about in the Bible since you were a child. It's going to be a very special tour of Israel, the Holy Land, March 9 through 17, 2017. We're taking a direct flight from New York to Tel Aviv. For all the information on this tour, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and leave us your name and your address, and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES, option 5. Or visit the website twholyland.com.
The Tide Radio Ministry is celebrating 69 years of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. I'm Don Shank, director of The Tide, and this is today's Global Update. Reflecting on the past 69 years of the Tide Ministry, we marvel at how God took a vision for a local radio ministry, reaching one small town, and transformed it into a global outreach that's bringing people around the world into relationship with Him. Our work now includes discipleship activities and radio programs in 23 languages. Three of those languages were just added this year, and already they're making a difference in the lives of many people. Like Marco, who says our latest Albanian language radio program is a blessing for him. He wrote, "I can learn a lot of things about God and how to live according to His Word. I see how my life is changing because of this program." To learn more about the Tide Ministry and help us share the gospel with more people like Marco, visit thetide.org. That's thetide.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and Commentary next. How would you like to finish your degree online? Truett McConnell University makes that possible with their top-notch online program. You can even earn a master's in theology. For 70 years, Truett McConnell University has been preparing students to fulfill God's high calling on their lives, on campus or online. A degree that can not only change your life, but also your workplace. Truett.edu is the website. That's Truett.edu. Rodney Ivester of Corinth, Texas, is the kind of guy you'd like as a neighbor. He maintains a tidy lawn, doesn't make much of a racket, and he flies an American flag. About 3 weeks ago, Rodney decided to post another flag alongside Old Glory, one that honors law enforcement. It's a black and white version of the U.S. flag, adorned with a blue stripe. But the other day, he got a letter from his homeowners association telling him the flag had to go. They called the pro-police flag noxious and offensive. And unless it comes down, he could face a big-dollar fine. Rodney asked to see a copy of the rule his flag violated, but so far the homeowners association hasn't been able to do that. Rodney says he's not the type to go looking for a fight, but he tells me that flag is not coming down. Be sure to download my podcast at toddstearns.com to hear the rest of Rodney's story. I'm Todd Stearns.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
As if parting the heavens, this mild-looking academician, Jay Ellison, Dean of Students at the University of Chicago, has struck what champions of free speech on college campuses regard as the biggest blow of the decade against the stifling effect of political correctness run amok. In a letter to the class of 2020, Ellison touted the university's commitment to academic diversity, warning freshmen, rigorous debate, discussion, and even disagreement may challenge you and even cause discomfort. In an era when liberal students across the country have sought and received the creation of safe spaces, zones where they can be shielded from ideas they regard as hurtful to their psyche, and demanded trigger warnings, advance notice from professors when their curricula could prompt an adverse emotional response, the Ellison letter served notice that the University of Chicago isn't having any of it. We do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. And we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own.
This is actually one of the best steps I've seen a university take to say, you know what, this is education, if done right, is actually going to be uncomfortable. University of Chicago has been leading the way when it comes to academic freedom and free speech, and I think every school in the country should adopt the University of Chicago principles.
The empire of academia strikes back, however. Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University, the alma mater of one Hillary Rodham, told the New York Times the Ellison letter was a publicity stunt designed to, quote, coddle donors. And writing at the Daily Beast, Dr. J. Michelson, a rabbi an LGBT activist who teaches at the Chicago Theological Seminary, accused Ellison of suppressing free speech in the name of free speech.
Instead of saying we don't believe in safe zones, he's actually creating a safe zone, and that's a safe zone for racism, homophobia, sexism on his college campus.
Administrators at the University of Chicago said professors there retain, quote, broad freedom in how they address concerns their students may have about the curriculum.
Hi, that was James Rosen on Special Report a couple of nights ago, and it really struck me, and I want to talk about it because school's getting ready to start. A lot of your kids are going off to various colleges around the nation, and it's time to talk about this again. Our next guest, Rochelle Peterson, is with the National Association of Scholars. I want to read you what Rochelle has written, and then we're going to talk. She has written, the 2016 college commencement season brought American higher education's year of the cry bullies, to a close. It was the academic year Geraldine Luther screamed obscenities at Yale's Silliman College headmaster, Nicholas Christakis, because he dared to create an intellectual space instead of a safe space for his students. Uncomfortable Learning, a Williams College student group whose mission is to host controversial speakers, canceled an event with John Derbyshire because his politically incorrect comments on race made Williams president Adam Falk too uncomfortable. Black Lives Matter protests erupted on more than 75 campuses, including Dartmouth, where activists took over a library and shouted obscenities at white students who declined to join them. And of course, the stories are numerous. There are so many more than these. This is Rochelle's condensation of a very vast problem. And she joins us this morning to talk about what the University of Chicago has just done. Good morning, Rochelle.
Good morning, Sandy.
All right, so University of Chicago, the dean sends out this letter, which is just pretty amazing. No safe spaces, no trigger warnings, no canceling invited speakers or bullying them. So I did think of you immediately, Rochelle, and wondered what you guys think of this. Is this as good as we think it is?
Well, the University of Chicago's letter is an excellent first step. It tells students up front that they cannot expect to be coddled, that demanding safe spaces and trigger warnings and expecting to disrupt speakers and demand disinvitations will not be accepted from them on campus. This is does a good job of setting the expectations of what a mature student will do on college campus when facing ideas that are uncomfortable or different to him. The problem with the University of Chicago's letter, though, is that it never defines what free expression is for. We get no purpose for free expression beyond getting a diversity of perspectives and a diversity of viewpoints. And diversity of viewpoints can be useful for establishing debate, but it's not the end goal of the university, which is to pursue the truth. So the university's letter does an excellent job of taking this first step towards getting students to appreciate a perspective that's different from theirs, but it doesn't go the full way to explain why they should appreciate that difference.
Rochelle, does any university in this country, college or university, actually say they want to pursue the truth anymore? Do any of them say that?
Well, the University of Chicago is unique for taking a stand for freedom of expression, and they do deserve praise for that. But again, the pursuit of truth is the purpose of higher education, and to keep a perpetually open mind is to never come down on what is actually true, and for the university to ask its students to perpetually be open-minded to adversity of viewpoints seems counterproductive to the purpose of learning.
Rochelle, let me tell you, because I lived through this, I'll tell you where this all started. And it sounds so innocuous and even humorous, but it's just when there was a moment in time where the United States and our whole understanding of things began to change, and it was that there was no truth. it didn't come on suddenly. It came down in subtle ways, like a Burger King commercial that, you know, said, have it your way, have it your way. Like, you know, and basically in commercials and in public discourse, we came to the notion that there was no right and wrong, that, you know, it's just what, you know, whatever you think has the same value as whatever somebody else thinks, and all opinions are equal. And so, and that's kind of, I think, where the American people are, and certainly universities on the cutting edge of that, that there is no truth. You know, it's just amazing. And that's what's caused all this chaos, that people can't even argue for truth anymore, because I don't think they have an understanding that there actually is a truth possible to discern. But Rochelle, we're coming, you know, here we come to the fall semester where students are going off. What do you expect to happen? Do you know if any other schools are taking at least some steps, like the University of Chicago, to sort of rein this thing in?
Well, no other university has issued a letter similar to the University of Chicago. Last year, several universities, including Purdue University and the Princeton faculty, adopted a statement of principles on academic freedom that was very similar to what the Chicago Committee on Free Expression put together. And that is a similar step towards protecting intellectual freedom. Again, that statement failed to explain what the purpose of debate is for. It has no mention of the pursuit of truth. As you were just saying, the pursuit of truth has been disdained in higher education for a long time. The problem with that position is that it leaves the university in a state of free speech absolutism, where they can't discriminate between what is mature, reasoned speech appropriate for a debate and appropriate in higher education, and what is screaming and yelling and not contributing to anything. And this leaves the university open to the criticism that has been made that it is becoming a safe space for administrators. It's becoming a safe space for bigots who don't want to be shouted down. And because the university has not grounded itself in the reasoned pursuit of truth and has grounded its views only in promoting a diversity of opinions, it doesn't have a strong position to come back against these criticisms.
Yeah, which is kind of the problem in every area of society, isn't it, Rochelle? People are not grounded. They don't even know what they believe, so they can't argue their position. They don't have confidence they just don't have any confidence because they've lost critical thinking skills. But let's talk about, you know, when I read about trigger warnings and safe spaces and, you know, all the other nonsense. What is the other thing? I thought there was a third one. I almost feel like I'm reading George Orwell. It's like, oh, I do feel like I'm reading George Orwell. Many of us cannot relate to that. Is this really, truly, these concepts, are they embraced by most American university students, or are these like more on the leftist fringe of things right now?
It is spanning the spectrum right now. Certainly, safe spaces and trigger warnings are more popular among students and faculty on the far left, but they're being championed at universities everywhere. This is not a phenomenon that we can ignore or that we can write off as a fringe movement. It is growing. Last year saw 75-plus protests and sit-ins along these lines. Universities are caving to these protests. At Yale, the president has announced a $50 million initiative to increase faculty diversity based on the demands that student protesters gave to him. Brown has announced $165 million in programming designed to placate student protests. So these students are succeeding in getting what they're demanding, and the movement will only continue to grow as they see that administrators are willing to cave into them.
You know, here's a story that just came out yesterday. Perhaps you've heard of it, Rochelle. It's at Clemson University. A girl who was part of Young Americans for Freedom was walking across campus. She saw a man sitting down, and he had an empty chair next to him that said the word prayer. So she sat down with him, and they prayed together. And as they were praying, a university administrator came to them and said, you can't pray there because this is not a designated free speech area. So, you know, I there's more to the story. I mean, well, more detail, but that's basically it. So they had to stop praying there because they had to go to a designated free speech zone to pray. That's the practical, that's a practical illustration of how ridiculous this has gotten. So is there any move, but you guys, is this, you have written an article, which I think is really interesting, Rochelle, and we're going to put this on our Facebook page, where you talk, well, you basically call it free speech versus free speech. And you say that many free speech enemies regard themselves as its champions. Now, I've seen these statements that you're talking about, but explain what you mean by that.
This is the same criticism that the University of Chicago has been getting from people on the left who are saying the university, by putting out this statement, is becoming a safe space for bigots. Similarly, at UMass Amherst last year, a student protester trying to shout down a speaker was horrified to find that she could be removed from the lecture because she was shouting down, because she thought her free speech enabled her to have her say at this event. Likewise, student protesters at Harvard tried to tear down posters from bulletin boards that they disagreed with, and they thought their free speech enabled them to censor speech that they disagreed with. So because free speech has been grounded simply in having your say and having a diversity of viewpoints and getting your viewpoint out there, rather than in any philosophical purpose, especially in the pursuit of truth, students on the left see their role in shouting down what they consider offensive speech to be part of their own free speech. In fact, they see it as a service to the rest of their students because they consider themselves to be kind of sticking it to the man. They're speaking truth to power, and their shouting down, I think, represents the minority viewpoint that isn't being heard. And so free speech demands letting them have their say. This is one symptom of what's happening now that the search for truth has been disdained on college campuses. Universities have little philosophical ground to push back against these students, and they're left with what the University of Chicago is doing, falling back on diversity of viewpoints.
Yes, and just to drive home what you just said, it isn't just their feeling that they have a right to express themselves and they call in any way, like shouting down, but they'll take over the microphone, or they will stop speakers from coming. So they're not just expressing their viewpoint. They are stopping others from expressing their viewpoint. So I still don't see how they make the quantum leap to that being free speech as a principle, not maybe in their own lives. Yeah, free speech. They're free to say what they think, but certainly not free speech applied to all people. How do they explain that that doesn't apply to everyone?
Well, in their viewpoint, there are certain perspectives that have been privileged, that have been given the microphone in the first place, for example, with the speaker example, and certain perspectives that are given more weight in college today. And so they believe that presenting a minority viewpoint, even if that requires shouting down someone in what they consider the majority, then that is sort of a balancing act. It balances the scales so that their perspective, which would otherwise be drowned out by the person holding the microphone, can be heard. Now, it's a convoluted argument, and there are a number of loops that a student has to jump through to make that case. But they're on decent grounds, given that the university has said its purpose is to promote a diversity of viewpoints. And if they can prove that their viewpoint is in the minority and it would add to the diversity by shouting it out, then they have pretty good logic there. What needs to be done is to explain what freedom of expression is for, that it requires humility and civility in listening to the other side, letting it make its best case, and then responding with reasons why you disagree and debating it out from there. It has to be linked to the pursuit of truth. It has to be part of a quest to come down on what is true rather than just shouting out your own viewpoint in order to add to the diversity.
Well, the National Association of Scholars is in the business of thinking through these things, writing articles, making the case. And if you'd like information like for your student or for yourself to kind of think through this, it's National Association of Scholars, NAS.org, right? NAS.org.
Yes.
And Rochelle's article, Free Speech versus Free Speech, is there. Plus, there's a great article, The Death of Campus Free Speech and How to Revive It, by Charles Lipson. So equip yourself so that you can talk to your kids, your students. They need a really good dose of truth right now as they enter the fall semester of 2016. Rochelle Peterson, thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
My pleasure, Sandy.
All right. Sandy Rios in the morning.
Since September 11, 2001, the U.S. has lost 7,000 lives and $2 trillion in the battle against global jihad. What is needed is a strategy that will allow us to win. What are the best strategies to defeat this threat? And is there an end to this war in sight? I'm Jerry Boykin, the former commander of the Delta Force and executive vice president of the Family Research Council here in Washington. Join me along with Philip Haney, Dr. Sebastian Gorka, and Dr. Zudi Jasser as we discuss these very issues. That's at the Values Voters Summit, September 9th through 11th in Washington, D.C. Please visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information and to register, or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
You can help plant seeds of the gospel and spread the message of the American Family Association by purchasing multiple copies of the AFA Journal, the monthly publication promoting a biblical standard of decency in American culture. Call 800-326-4543, option 2, and learn about placing copies of the journal in your church, school, office, or place of business. 800-326-4543, option 2.
Hi, this is Tom Wallace of Fortress of Faith. I want to invite you to catch our show each Saturday at 12 noon Central Time. I was a foreign missionary, and my partner, Sharam, was a former Muslim who is now a Christian pastor. Together, we have many years of experience and research in the religion of Islam. Fortress of Faith exposes the evil of this ideology that is masquerading as a religion. For more information, go to fortressoffaith.com. That's fortressoffaith.com.
Hi, this is Dan Celia from Financial Issues. You know, the charitable gift annuity concept is more important today than probably ever. It is something that you have heard me talk about for many, many years. And right now, for now, the tax code is still allowing charitable organizations to establish a charitable gift annuity so that you can be guaranteed permanent income for the rest of your life. Don't waste any time. So many of you have IRAs, 401k money. Peel off a piece of that. Establish your charitable gift annuity so that you have a portion of permanent income that you know is never going to change for the rest of your life. Would you do it today? Call AFA Foundation, 800-326-4543. Extension 345. That's 800-326-4543. Extension 345.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Hillary Clinton's FBI certified extremely careless handling of classified information isn't the only manifestation of her wanton disregard for U.S. national security. For nearly 20 years, her closest aide has been a woman with extensive family and personal ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, Huma Abedin. 12 years ago, the U.S. government obtained the Brotherhood's secret plan for destroying Western civilization from within. The document laid out how the group advances this agenda via stealthy jihadist subversion and influence operations. For years, the Clinton machine has vilified anybody who questioned whether Huma Abedin used her official positions to benefit Islamic supremacism. Donald Trump is the latest to get such treatment, but seems unlikely to be intimidated into ignoring the obvious. Hillary Clinton has arguably done more personally for the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist cause than any other U.S. official. Think that's a coincidence? This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Well, there was an interesting report by Shannon Bream yesterday on a special report about the number of federal justices that Barack Obama has appointed. It's at least 30% of the bench. And they are all lifetime appointments. And Shannon was going into great detail about the differences they're making. For instance, the lower court decision in North Carolina on the bathroom issue. That court used to be a court that was more conservative, and it isn't anymore because of Barack Obama's appointment. So there is a systematic effort to change our justice system. Make no mistake about it. We talk a lot about the next Supreme Court nominee, but it's not just that. It's the lower courts as well. The Supreme Court can only hear a few cases. And so the lower courts have tremendous power. And now we're learning that George Soros, remember those leaked memos, which, by the way, the whole story about those leaked memos has been scrubbed, the evidence of that. But some people have taken screenshots, thank goodness. We know that George Soros now has spent $3 million in seven local district attorney campaigns in six states over the past year. That's a sum that exceeds the total spent on the 2016 presidential campaign, but all but a handful of rival super donors. So we know George Soros. At the top of the hour, you heard the story in our news bit about his spending tons of money to help Planned Parenthood defend itself in the wake of the outbreak of the news that they were selling little baby body parts. Part of the leaked information also tells us that Soros he's pushing for the federal control of our police departments. You know, we've talked about this, how the Justice Department is going into various police departments, Chicago now, New Orleans, Baltimore, writing these scathing reports and then creating this accountability to the federal system and basically federalizing the police. Well, that's all coming from Soros money. I've told you about George. I'm getting, my file on George Soros is thickening as we see all of the things that he has his billions in. And in case you're just now listening and have never heard me mention George Soros, he's a Hungarian-born billionaire whose goal is really to subvert and destroy the American system. And he's been very effective at it. And now this morning, I'm learning, yesterday, that we're finding out that George Soros also would like the internet to be taken over by international entities. Now, we have discussed this before, but the imminent turning over of the control of the internet and all the implications thereof is going to be September the 30th. And so far, no one has done anything about it. I've asked Rick Manning to join us again this morning. He seems to be really the most knowledgeable on this issue single-handedly here in the Washington, D.C. area. Rick is the president of Americans for Limited Government, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Rick.
Morning, Sandy. How are you?
I'm fine. You know we have to revisit a little bit of this. I know that the President Obama has been pushing for this international control, and what would that mean to people listening? What would that mean to us?
Well, up front, I don't think you would notice a dramatic difference. You wouldn't suddenly get the blue screen of death just because this occurred. But what it does is it shifts control away from the United States, where you have First Amendment protections on speech, and to a body that is, quite honestly, would be run by Google and those kind of people, which is open to content controls, open to coercion from countries like China and the like. And as a result, you're making the internet much less safer. In the long haul, what you would end up seeing is you would end up seeing a less free and open internet because certain contents would eventually end up not being allowed. They would not allow certain words to be part of internet domain names. They would also likely figure out how to purge those words from documents, and yeah, would make that part of the process of whether or not you're able to make money by selling .com, .org, or .net, or various other .entities to people who have websites like me. So that's your. So ultimately, you'll end up having a lot less information coming through the web, and the average person won't even know it because they won't know that it's not there.
You know, Rick. This is not
much
even
like the scrubbing that you described in your description. Effectively, information will be scrubbed from the web, and people won't even know it existed.
Well, this is already we don't have to imagine, because Google is already doing this. I was just reading a couple of days ago about how they have made it. However they do it, by scrambling the word orders or whatever, they have removed your ability to find content about Hillary Clinton's health. They've changed the wording, and they talk. I read a comparison between Bing and Google, and how if you tried to research her physical, her medical condition, you couldn't find information on Google. So they're already doing things like this. You know that, Rick. And they're also, we have situations where Twitter is, you know, censoring people who are conservative. We also have this whole issue. Now, this is projection. We have the whole issue of the movement of the Organization of Islamic States and their international move to stop criticism of the Prophet, which Hillary Clinton is very much a part of. So one can only imagine what's going to happen to the Internet if the United States, who exercises the First Amendment, loses control. And so, Rick, I just said that the Obama administration is pushing this, but who else? Well, I mentioned Soros, too. Maybe you could fill in the blanks on Soros a little bit.
Well, the people who've been pushing it have been a series of technology groups that are really tied together because they're basically Silicon Valley-funded groups. This is a part of their kind of lifetime dream of having an internet that is not responsive to any government and is in fact a free and floating entity. Unfortunately, their dream is not the reality in how it works. They believe that by taking away U.S. oversight, and recognize this, Sandy, U.S. oversight is very, very light. All the U.S. does is if there's a change in the roots in the backbone of the internet that's needed, they make sure they're not messing it up. And if ICANN, the people who want to take it over, try to raise fees too much to get websites, at that point they say, wait a second, you got to back off on that. So it's very, very light touch oversight, but it is oversight. And the most important part of it is, by virtue of having the federal government, this group managing the internet, acting as a contractor of the federal government, you have the capacity, you have First Amendment protections that are there as a result. And so the key to this is you have recourse. Whereas if Google strips out the words for Hillary Clinton or somebody takes away your Twitter account or if Facebook does something you don't like, you really have no recourse. They're a private entity. They do what they want to do. There's no First Amendment protections against private entity engaging in using their platform however they want to. There is First Amendment protections with that private entity as a government contractor. And that's why we need to maintain the government link, because delinking it delinks the internet from First Amendment protections, and that's the dangerous thing.
You know, the other illustration that comes to mind, I'm sure I told you, Rick, this, but I actually never did anything about this just because I'm busy. But we, you know, many of us, you included, sort of participated in creating this compilation video of those Planned Parenthood body parts videos. And I put the condensed version on my Facebook page, my show Facebook page, and we had, oh gosh, thousands and thousands and thousands of views. And then
right.
Facebook took it off. They removed it. They said it didn't meet their something about community standards, whatever their words were. The point is, this is what I believe likely will face if we lose control of this. So let's bring it back to what's happening. I know there's some really good, strong opposition on Capitol Hill, but how come they haven't done anything yet?
Well, they have, and this is the important thing that we need to know. For the last 2 years, proceeding with this has been defunded by the Congress. So President Obama signed the defund, so it was law. And President Obama has ignored that. He has effectively moved forward with the transition, spent money to do it, in spite of the Congress's specific prohibition on doing so. And as a result, there are some people on Capitol Hill who are extremely upset about this. Representative John Culberson, who is the chairman of the subcommittee of the Appropriations Subcommittee that did defund it, is really involved in it, is up in arms. And so what we're doing right now is we're going to go and we're going to try to directly tell President Obama that he has to extend the contract with this ICANN group and keep the internet, that contract intact. We're working it through a variety of sources. a variety of people on Capitol Hill, but we've got Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Grassley is on board. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte's on board. We've got appropriators on board. Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Jim Lankford are all pushing this. So we have a lot of different resources from different areas that are pushing really hard to stop this and using this upcoming funding bill that they're going to do in September. Secondly, Congress needs to get ready to sue President Obama over this, because it is a direct violation of Article 1, power of the purse, and they need to be ready to sue him so they can stop this from going forward. So on October 1, the keys to the castle aren't turned over and never to be retrieved. So they have to be ready to file a suit, and that needs to be being prepared right now. We're urging Speaker Ryan and Leader McConnell to do that, and you know, we'll see what they do, but there's a lot of resources at play. Your listeners need to tell their congressman, don't give away the internet, and if they want to go to a website, it's stoptheinternetgiveaway.org.
Okay, stoptheinternetgiveaway.org. We'll put that on our Facebook page so people can find it. In fact, I'm going to link to that article I referenced a minute. We'll put that up too. In fact, what article would you suggest, Rick, and we'll put it on our Facebook page, of all that's been written? I know you've written a lot about it.
Well, if you want a comprehensive view, we testified before the Senate Commerce Committee on this about 2 or 3 months ago, and I put together a pretty comprehensive tour through the whole issue, everything from property rights to antitrust law. So if you really want a comprehensive thing, just Google Senate Commerce and Rick Manning, and you'll get my testimony. If you just want one article, I would actually go to the StopTheInternetGiveaway.com website, and I have a number of articles that are on there that are pretty comprehensive.
Okay.
It will help anybody understand this in detail, in whatever detail they want to understand it.
Well, you know, the thing, you know, you and I think this is at least the third or fourth time you and I've talked about this. It's not because there's so many issues, and under ordinary circumstances, this would be huge, but it gets pushed to the side. And I just don't think it's common knowledge, and yet it should be because it's so important. We only have a couple of minutes left here, Rick, but the thing that comes to my mind, you know, I started this segment talking about that Shannon Bream report on the appointment of so many lower court judges. And I was thinking, you know, the D.C. Circuit, are they the ones that would ultimately hear a matter of dispute between the Congress and the president on him spending money he wasn't authorized to spend?
Exactly right. It would be the D.C. Circuit. And we know that President Obama stacked the D.C. Circuit just a couple of years ago. But to take Shannon Bream's point further in the one you're making, right now President Obama has put about 30% of federal court judges on. But if Hillary Clinton is elected over the next 8 years, 3/4 of the judges, federal judges, will be appointed by Obama or Hillary. Think about that. You would have effectively the federal judiciary would be a reflection of the vision for America that Obama and Hillary have. And we know that when the left controls the judiciary, they don't hesitate to overturn anything that Congress wants to do that might roll back some of this nonsense. So we have so there's a lot at stake in terms of the judiciary. But if Hillary Clinton's elected president in this election, the federal judiciary will be a far left judiciary for the remainder of my lifetime.
Yes, and probably most people's listening, really. All right, for more information that you can share, stoptheinternetgiveaway.com, stoptheinternetgiveaway.com. September 30th is the deadline, and so it's time to make calls to our congressmen, our senators, and tell them to stop it. Stop the president and stop this whole transfer, which is illegal. In any case, it's illegal because of the money that he spent that he was not authorized to spend. Rick Manning, Americans for Limited Government. Rick, thanks for your fine reporting. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Sandy. Appreciate it. Anytime.
All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.